Good morning. Welcome. It's Monday, the 7th of October. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Up first, it's our current events discussion, the Roundtable panel. Today marks 1 year since the Hamas attack on Israel, which killed over 1,200 people and led to the subsequent war in Gaza. The anniversary is prompting vigils and protests around the globe. This morning, we'll be joined by an outstanding panel of experts, Ambassador Fred Hoff, Libby Post, and Professor Nathan Brown, to discuss the Middle East, the anniversary, and much more. Later on today, Professor and Chair of Political Science from Hartwick College, Laurel Elder, will be here. Laurel is co-director of the Institute of Public Service, along with Professor of Sociology Zachary McKenney, who will join us as well, as will two of their students, to discuss the importance of the youth vote. All of that coming up in the roundtable this morning, on the roundtable this morning. Let me introduce our guest, and we will get right to it on this Monday morning. First of all, we welcome diplomat in residence at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff. Good morning, Fred. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Doing just fine. Delighted to be with you.
Thank you very much for being with us. We also welcome political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good, and good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for being with us. And Nathan Brown joins us for the first time, a political science professor at George Washington University and a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Dr. Brown, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So now you know Fred. What can you tell us about Fred that we don't know?
Very, very little. He's had a distinguished public career, very much out in the open, but working on Middle East issues for longer than I think he would care.
Well, I appreciate you being here, and I thank you very much for your time and your contributions to the conversation this morning.
Well, Joe, if I might just add, with Nate Brown on the program this morning, I think my best contribution would be utter silence.
Well, I hope you don't do that, but I understand. That very nice compliment, but speak up, Fred. We need you today. So we are talking, of course, today is October 7th. It is the 1 year anniversary of the attacks in Gaza. And it's really a time to sort of take stock of where we are and where we've come over the past year, and to look at where we are. It has been 1 year since Hamas terrorists smashed through Gaza's northern border and killed 1,200 Israelis, many civilians, and kidnapped 251 more, setting off the deadliest war in the already lethal history of conflicts in the Palestinian territories. Yet the death toll, including an estimated 40,000 Palestinians in Gaza, perhaps half of them civilians — the official statistics make no such distinctions — may mark a mere prelude to the carnage ahead. For with this invasion's anniversary, we are seeing the widening of the war that many have feared from its very beginning. So, Nathan Brown, let us begin with you of how you see this anniversary and how you think we should look at it, especially with what has occurred and what is possible to come.
Well, it is just a very discouraging time, I think, for people who live in the region, certainly for those of us here who follow it. I heard a rather depressing Israeli joke about a month ago saying, if you want to see the light at the end of the tunnel, turn around and look back. We joked at the beginning about Ambassador Hoff's career. A quarter century ago, he was working on a peace process that looked like it could produce things like a general regional peace, an Israeli-Palestinian peace. Those two things perhaps, working together. And right now, I think what we're looking at is just something very, very different. On the Israeli-Palestinian front, we've certainly seen a year of deadly conflict, but one that doesn't look like it's going to produce, or that either side really expects it to produce, anything like a peaceful or fair outcome. And at a regional level, we've certainly seen some escalation. We've seen actors that seem to think that they can modulate the degree of escalation, and to some extent they have. The total confrontation between Israel and Iran has not yet happened, but still the level of violence that is occurring right now and the prospects for any sort of political reconstruction in places like Lebanon just seem very, very far away. So I hate to start the morning off on such a sour note, but I really think that the past year, what we saw happen over the past year is likely to continue in some form over the coming year.
Well, you're certainly not alone in that pessimistic view, I think. And, you know, it is, the situation is what it is. Ambassador Hoff.
Yeah, I think Nate Brown has it exactly right as far as the trajectory we seem to be facing. You know, there will be no relaxation, I'm sure, of American diplomatic efforts to find off ramps from this violence. But the prospects are not good. So, you know, since we're focusing on October 7th, I think it's worth saying that for Israelis, the events of that day a year ago amounted to a sort of a combination of Pearl Harbor and 9/11. It was the worst attack on Jews since the Holocaust. It was the worst attack on Jews since the creation of Israel. And the trauma that these attacks induced remains powerful within Israel a year later. 30 years after the promise of the Oslo Accords, most Israelis now believe that Palestinians in general, not just Hamas, want them gone, dead, or some combination thereof. And I think this belief was reflected in the way Israel reacted to October 7th. Days after the attacks, Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, a person left of center in the Israeli political spectrum, said publicly that there was no such thing as an innocent Palestinian civilian. The defense minister at the time said that nothing, no food, no water, no medicine, nothing would be permitted to enter the Gaza Strip until hostages returned and perpetrators of the horrible, horrible violence of October 7th killed. You know, from the very beginning, American officials urged their Israeli counterparts to act with caution. They knew that Hamas and Iran were counting on Israel to conduct combat operations that would kill thousands of civilians. They knew Hamas and Iran wanted to kill the prospect of Israeli-Saudi normalization, that they wanted to isolate Israel in the region, and they wanted to convince the whole world that the United States was encouraging civilian slaughter. American officials tried to convince their Israeli counterparts to wait until a plan reflecting achievable political military objectives and a strategy to achieve them could be created. They urged their Israeli counterparts to treat Palestinian civilians as people who could be separated and alienated from Hamas. And I've got to say, the Israeli reaction to this advice and to nearly all American advice over the past year has been a mixture of incredulity, outrage, and even contempt. Most Israelis wanted vengeance. Prime Minister Netanyahu, who was widely, and I think justifiably, blamed for Israel's lack of preparedness on October 7th, wanted to strike hard and fast. So this is where we are.
Libby Post.
I'm not going to get into the international relations part of this because we have two experts and, you know, I stopped my study of international relations when I came here to Albany.
Right.
So what I can talk about is the impact that this has had on the Jewish community here in not the Capital Region, but in the United States. And this is ripping apart the Jewish community as well. But my major concern since all of this has happened is the rise of in anti-Semitism that we are seeing everywhere. But in the United States, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, tracks anti-Semitic incidents. And they went, there was more than a 200% increase from October 7th, 2022, before the year before, but within this the time frame of October 7th, 2023 and September 24th of this year, there's been more than a 200% increase in anti-Semitic incidences. You know, we just came off of, we're in the midst of the high holidays. Thursday and Friday was Rosh Hashanah. The governor put out a message saying that there were numerous bomb threats into synagogues across the state. You know, she said that they will stay vigilant through today. I'm hoping they stay vigilant, and I know we will stay vigilant, and the governor will too, through this weekend, because it's Yom Kippur. It starts Friday night, all day Saturday. And it's the whole, this is, you know, these 10 days are the holiest days of on our calendar. And for those of us who do observe and in our various ways, because we don't all observe the same way, that's the great thing about Judaism, is that we want to feel safe. We want to feel like we can go to shul, go to synagogue, and not have to worry. And, you know, one of the first things that came out after the first set of prayers at services was the rabbi talking about, this is the security situation, those are the doors, if anything happens, God forbid, you know where to go, all that sort of stuff. I've been in at services when we've done, you know, security drills. You know, like remember when we were kids, we would do the fire drills? Well, these are security drills, and we have to go outside through certain doors with our hands up so that nobody thinks we have guns. I mean, it's really, to have the sacredness of a house of worship terrorized like this, regardless if something happens, it's just the threat. But then we do see the incidences of anti-Semitism growing. And at the beginning of all of this, and after October 7th, you know, I think the world was with the Jewish community. When Israel responded the way it did and kept responding and the hostages weren't released, that narrative changed. And so now we have this blur between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. And I keep hearing people saying, well, if you're anti-Zionist, it doesn't mean that you're anti-Semitic. And I think that's true for the most discerning intellectual mind who can see the difference between the two. But how we've seen it played out on college campuses, that's for sure, is that it's a distinction without a difference. And Jewish students are being targeted just for being Jewish. And, oh, if you're Jewish, that means you're a Zionist and I hate you. And so we see this over and over and over again. And so this notion that we can separate easily Zionism and Judaism is more and more difficult every day because of the geopolitics at play.
Nathan Brown, talk a little bit about that in the sense of what we've been seeing on college campuses, especially, I know you've written extensively on this when it comes to the pro-Palestinian opinion being expressed on campuses and how that is dealt with the various administrations of colleges and universities.
Yes, it's a difficult issue, or I would say it was an extremely difficult issue last year. This year seems to be much quieter. And I think there are a few things going on. I think what happened after it, just on October 7th itself, and certainly in the days afterwards, was just a lot of people kind of retreated into their camps, and an awful lot of expression that we heard was people talking essentially within their own camps. I mean, Ambassador Hoff mentioned some of the rhetoric that was coming out in Israel. You certainly heard Palestinians diminishing what happened on October 7th, even sometimes denying the scale of what had happened on October 7th, or that sort of thing. You heard horrific rhetoric from American politicians calling for use of nuclear weapons on Gaza and this sort of thing. So just the level of dehumanization in ordinary discourse was absolutely alarming. And I think there was division within each community, within the American Jewish community, mm-hmm. absolutely, a generational split, a denominational split in just how the issues were seen. How Israel was seen, how Gaza was seen, how Palestinians were seen, and so on. And it was just an atmosphere where I think my own personal experience, actually, after saying all that, is it could be actually much happier in small groups. You're talking face-to-face to people who recognize each other's humanity, and you could have sophisticated exchanges of views. Once you moved out into public, sometimes the shrillest voices just drowned out all the others. And the way in which people just understood only the pain of specific actors or specific people was just really dispiriting. I think that's beginning to ease a little bit now, but the past year was just one of the ugliest that I've ever seen in a set of issues and a set of conflicts that have never been known for producing only civil dialogue.
Fred, the idea, I mean, the New York Times writes about this today, the war that won't end, and how what happened on October 7th 1 year ago sparked this year of conflict. And I guess that brings us to a point that I just want to talk about, which we've been talking to and around, but that is the future and how we move forward, because there is plenty of room for the pessimists. Thank you. I appreciate your assistance. Hey. That'd be always good. Pessimism is what I was ultimately trying to say. There's an understanding, obviously, of why that exists, and it's hard to look at where we are, and I'd like to talk about that exactly where we are now. And the possibility of this broadening over perhaps hours or days.
Yeah, we're seeing the broadening. The recent Iranian missile attack on Israel. There will be an Israeli response to that. For the past year, most of the focus has been on Gaza, where the amount of civilian suffering has been beyond horrific. 42,000 people killed, the Gaza Strip destroyed, 95% of 2 million people displaced. As I've mentioned previously, Joe, the heart of the problem here between Israeli Jews and Palestinians is that each side considers itself to be the righteous mm-hmm. victim of the other side. These are sincerely held views. Understanding this, trying to employ two-way empathy, I think is the key to being part of the solution instead of being part of the problem. But as Nate mentions, it didn't take very long at all for people to retreat into camps. What I hear, all too often is commentary that exhibits no empathy for the other side, and quite often doesn't even refer to the equities and interests of the home team, namely the United States. Our government keeps urging Israel, put all this violence in a political context with achievable political objectives. I've gotten to the point, Joe, where I think, you know, Israelis, just starting with the prime minister, just look at this as lunacy from the United States. They've taken the opinion that conflict with the world around Israel is permanent, and that all you can do is reduce the capabilities of your enemies through violence, buy some time until the next round. That is not a very optimistic view. It's not a view I agree with. But when the parties to the conflict, whether it's Israel or Hamas, do not want off ramps, more than the United States, when the United States is trying to convince parties that think that the current course is preferable to a suspension and elimination of violence, that is a tough diplomatic problem to solve.
Libby,
I think I've said this before. Netanyahu is going to keep this going so that he stays out of jail, right? You know, we know that that's the possibility for him once he no longer is prime minister, and he is, just digging in a way that I don't think anybody with rational thought would have thought he would do, right? I mean, nobody expected the kind of response. Nobody expected the routing of the Palestinians in Gaza and what's happened there. And it's a tragedy, and it's an incredible loss of life. Then he goes from Gaza to the north, and now to the West Bank, and now with what's going on in Lebanon, and it's all playing into Iran's hands, and they're the ones who didn't want, as you pointed out, Fred, they didn't want Israel and Saudi Arabia to normalize relations, and that would have happened on October 7th, 2023, or October 8th, 2023, if October 7th hadn't happened. And so, there's the puppet master here is really Iran. And, we need to recognize this. The United States can only do so much. I think this notion that people are upset that we're giving Israel armaments and all of that. The fact of the matter is that they are our ally, and they are the only democracy in the Middle East still. We may not like the players in that democracy right now. It's unclear from my perspective whether those players are going to survive, and if they do, what that means to that democracy, because it's becoming more theocratic than democratic in Israel because of the coalition that Netanyahu has put together with the religious right in Israel. So there's all these moving parts, and I think, the Ayatollah and everybody else over there in Iran are just sitting back and laughing and watching this whole thing implode, sending a missile now and then, knowing that Israel's going to shoot down their missiles, and knowing that Biden and the United States is going to say, do not bomb their nuclear facilities because, A, of the environmental impact and the amount of people who will be killed, but, B, it will start World War III. And if I think the only cudgel we have is the armaments to hold over Israel to make them not do it.
I would love to have Nate Brown's view on this, but the only thing I'd say, Libby, is that the Iranian laughter right now is a bit under control.
Yes, it is.
Seeing what Israel has done to its all-important, vital proxy in Lebanon, Hezbollah. But I think Nate probably has some views on that.
Nate.
Yeah, I would disagree at the beginning about this not being predictable. I think it was fairly clear at the beginning that Well, a couple of things were very clear from the beginning. Number one, the Hamas leadership went into this basically hoping to shake things up, not having any strategic follow-up or anything like this. They undertook something that was a horrific a horrific attempt, targeting Israeli civilians, taking a large number of hostages, killing innocent people, without regard for what would happen afterwards. On the Israeli side, it was fairly clear from the beginning that, I mean, Israeli officials would say things like, "Well, we've learned that deterrence does not work." And what that meant was that instead of trying to intimidate their enemies, they actually had to destroy them. And so what happened in Gaza, I think, was a little bit more predictable. You could see not the precise contours of the Israeli military response, but there would be something very, very substantial, and the mood in Israel was such that there would be no pushback towards there would be pushback if there were provisions, for instance, for letting in food and medicine and so on. And so that was clear from the beginning. What was a little less clear from the beginning is what would happen regionally, whether there would be a full-scale war between Israel and Hezbollah, whether Iran would get involved, and so on. At this point, I think what has happened is I would be closer to what Fred has said. Iran has been dealt a series of short-term, you could say, defeats or humiliations, and we haven't seen any response from them. Whether that's going to be the story in the long term, I don't know. What we have seen, I think, is that Israel has essentially won every single battle of this. It's won it in Gaza. It seems to it dealt Hezbollah a very severe blow. What is unclear is what happens afterwards. What happens when you defeat opponents like this in a battle, but they live to fight another day or to find some other kind of way of carrying on their struggle? What Hamas did on October 7th, if you listen to Palestinians, will say, well, look, what else were they supposed to do? They were bottled up in Gaza. There was no way out, and so on. I have no trouble saying that Palestinians and Israelis, neither side, has good choices, had and certainly had good choices. I have no trouble condemning the choices that Hamas made on October 7th, but I don't think that this struggle is over, and I don't see any kind of way that Israel has of turning its military tactical victories or battlefield victories into any kind of strategic orientation that will make them safer in the region. If I can play devil's advocate for the Israeli position, I think it might be something like this. It would be to say, look, Iran is never going to accept us. Hamas is never going to accept us. What we're doing is not starting a forever war. We are always going to be in a forever war. That wasn't our choice, and that is simply the war that we have to fight. So I think that's how they would put it. Israeli leaders, not just Netanyahu himself, but basically certainly the right side of the political spectrum, but even the center, would I think that kind of argument would resonate. We don't have an awful lot of choice to do exactly what we're doing. But even those people in the center who would make that argument, I think, would still have an awful lot of nervousness, not about today or tomorrow, but what this spells out for the next generation, for the society, and the fate of the society where their children are growing up. That's where a lot of Israelis have very, very deep concerns.
You're listening to a special roundtable panel this morning. We are talking about the anniversary of the October 7th, 2023 attacks that sparked a year of conflict and looking at where we are 1 year later. Our guest this morning, former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat. He taught at Bard College for 6 years and now senior fellow at Bard College for Civic Engagement. Ambassador Fred Hoff is with us. Political consultant Libby Post is here. And Nathan Brown, a political science professor at George Washington University and a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And again, we thank you all for being with us. Dr. Brown, let me ask you about Netanyahu and what we should make of his current state. I vividly remember in the days and weeks after the October 7th attacks, talking on this program to many experts who predicted that his term would be fleeting and that he probably wouldn't make it to the end of the month of October. That obviously has not been the case. So what should we make of that and the continuing power that he holds?
Well, it's clear that what Netanyahu has managed to do has been to fend off a series of international and domestic challenges. The international, Fred Hoff talked about essentially pressure from the United States, which essentially the approach has been to listen patiently to the United States, but then to do what they thought needed to be done. Domestically, he was in a shaky position before October 7th. Essentially, this was a very badly polarized society, and about half the population, or just slightly under half, according to election returns, really regarded him not simply as pursuing bad policies, but as undermining Israeli democracy. And half the population was very much in support of him. When October 7th happened, he came under very, very strong personal criticism as having essentially been asleep at the switch, and having, in a sense, abetted the situation which made October 7th possible. There's the way the Israeli political system works is you just need essentially half the Knesset, half the parliament in support of you. And going to new elections right now and, you know, perhaps losing his majority was something that nobody in that coalition wanted to do. So he's been able to stay afloat. It's been there was an attempt to briefly to broaden the coalition that did not work out very well. And so I think what we're looking at is the likelihood, not the certainty, but the likelihood of him remaining in office for a considerable period. I don't want, however, to go and ascribe all of Israeli decisions simply to Netanyahu and his personal interests. Those who are critical of Netanyahu, especially in Israel, do that. But he's at the head of a coalition that is basically center and center right, and some of the members of his coalition are very, very extreme, talking essentially saying, you know, there is no such thing as a Palestinian. There are, you know, Arabs who live here on the land, they're welcome to stay as long as they're peaceful, but they won't have, many of them will not have citizenship rights. And you know, what his finance minister, who's a very influential member, basically says, and if they don't like that, well, there's always a military solution. You've got extremely strong rhetoric from the right of his coalition. And that's the context in which his policy is being made. So I don't see that changing necessarily anytime soon, if there were new elections or if the current coalition broke apart, which is possible. You might be able to put together, you might see a more of a centrist coalition that I think would trim some of those very extreme voices. But I'm not sure it would be a sea change in policy, at least with Palestinians. I don't think that the opponents of Netanyahu in the center and then the left really have much of a viable alternative that they can present to Israeli voters that anybody's in a mood to hear right now.
Fred Hoff, I'm interested in your thoughts on the question that we were just talking about. But I also would like to, at the same time, broaden the conversation a little bit to the United States and what we're doing as far as the tumult we see between President Biden and Netanyahu, and what we make of that in terms of the overall question about Netanyahu's tenure.
Yeah, first with respect to Netanyahu, I think Nate Brown, as usual, has it right. I spent a lot of time back in 2010, 2011. negotiating with Prime Minister Netanyahu, getting to know him quite well. I must say, he is a very thoughtful, calculating person, and he is a master of Israeli politics. Of course, there are many people in Israel who can be mobilized on almost any day to demonstrate against his tenure in office, and the issue of Israeli hostages. Ongoing attempts to basically change the constitutional nature of Israel are key issues. But look, you know, many of us over the years, and I think Nate Brown would be included in this, have thought that that ultimately what really needs to happen is self-determination for Palestinians. In the form of two states living side by side in peace and with a great deal of economic integration. Right now, on the Israeli side, there is no appetite for that. The promise of Oslo back in 1993 has evaporated. Public opinion polls show that something on the order of 75% of Israelis are opposed to a Palestinian state because they believe it would be a Hamas state, and that such a state would put them and their country in peril. What Bibi Netanyahu brings to the table is his own personal opposition to the emergence of a Palestinian state, something he speaks about often now, telling Israelis, "I am the one person who has opposed this, and who will keep it from happening." The United States, the Biden administration, continues in its efforts, certainly in the Israel-Palestinian, Israel-Hamas context. The United States continues to try to persuade both sides, especially Israel, using intermediaries to communicate with Hamas, to go for an off-ramp, to go for a 6-week ceasefire. That ideally would evolve into a permanent cessation of hostilities. Prime Minister Netanyahu and Yahya Sinwar are on the same page with regard to a ceasefire. They both oppose it. And just reading about and speaking with friends about all of this, Biden administration attempts to persuade Israel of this, that, or the other thing. I find it, I'm sorry to be so blunt, but I find it hard not to conclude that Prime Minister Netanyahu holds President Biden in utter contempt. That's just the sense I have. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think I am.
And the entire administration, so that would include Blinken and everybody else.
Sure.
I think that you're right. He does hold them in contempt, clearly, because he's not willing to sit down and negotiate. He's not willing to do that ceasefire, which could definitely help dampen everything. And he wants to keep this going because he sees public opinion. Those wins at his back. But this whole notion of I know what's right sounds eerily like someone else, right, that we're dealing with in this country who also says, I can take care of everything. I know what's right. Just elect me president and everything will be taken care of. I think that they are Trump and Netanyahu, two peas in the pod. And the danger of that particular coalition could very well spell out World War III.
Yeah, but go back to, I agree, but going back to Nate's point, I think about Bibi's survivability. I think that where we stand right now, Netanyahu does reflect pretty strong Israeli majority public opinion on these key issues.
So, Nathan Brown, where do we go from here in the sense of what unfolds even in the coming days and weeks? I mean, we are expecting a retaliation, and from there, I mean, there's some of this that we can see what's going to unfold before us.
Yeah, well, there's where we're likely to go and where we should go, and I guess there's a question of who we are. So
Right. Where
we're likely to go, and we here being just the world, I think we're at a very dangerous state of the conflict, but one in which I'll defer to others who have much more expertise at a broad regional level than I do. I'd love to hear Fred Haas' view on this. I think right now, kind of the basic terms of the conflict, at least for the short term, seem to be clear, and they seem to be Hezbollah has been dealt a very severe blow, and Iran's response will come later at a time in a means of its own choosing, but not necessarily immediately. So we've been in a dangerous phase, but one that won't necessarily get worse. Longer term, however, every single problem that has led to this horrible state of affairs is still very much there, festering below the surface or sometimes on the surface. And here we being the United States, what is it the United States should do? I think any kind of major American initiative before the new administration comes in January is extremely unlikely. Does seem to me that some kind of broad and muscular initiative to try and resolve regional disputes, Israel and Iran, Israel and the Palestinians and Lebanon, is necessary. This will come; otherwise, they will come back in ways that will be just as dangerous at the present. But whatever new administration comes in January, it just is not going to have the tools that were available to American diplomats 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and so on. There are a few tools. The idea of regional normalization, I think, is probably more alive now than it was. But for the most part, a viable Israeli-Palestinian peace process, really even a viable Palestinian leadership. And those sorts of ingredients are missing. And you've got a generation now of American foreign policy specialists who basically come of age, I think, seeing this as a horrible conflict, which they just don't know how to deal with. So there may be very little appetite for it. So should there be some broad regional approach that recognizes national rights for Israelis, national rights for Palestinians, the security of existing states in the region, and so on. Should there be? Yes, but I don't see how it will. I don't see what it would look like whoever is in the White House in January.
We welcome your letters on this and your comments. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, and we'll get to those after the top of the hour. Fred Haas.
Yeah, I would agree with Nate, and I suspect that as a practical matter, the only thing the United States might be able to accomplish near term, and therefore where the focus of American diplomacy and whatever pressure we can bring to bear should be, is on the humanitarian situation. What's been happening in Gaza over the past year is just unacceptable. 42,000 dead, a totally destroyed area, people displaced. This simply has to stop. And I totally agree. It's not time for the United States to try to set up some kind of mediation to solve Israeli Palestinian statehood issues and all of that, but focusing on the humanitarian, and we're seeing in Lebanon now 2,000 civilians killed since the Israeli air assaults started in earnest a couple of uh, couple of weeks ago. The civilian carnage in all of this, starting a year ago today, has just been amazing and unacceptable.
Libby?
We just have to remember that both Hezbollah and Hamas use their civilians as human shields. That's been proven over and over and over again. So while the carnage is horrible, and I don't condone all of this killing in any way, this is not conventional warfare, as you knew it, has been thrown out the window. And it's very difficult to be able to go after leaders of a country that's fighting against you, right? It's just much more difficult now because everything's guerrilla-like. Everything is, you know, the World War II model is no longer around. And so, you know, we just have to remember that part of all of this is that when those in power use their civilians as human shields, it's very difficult for there not to be bloodshed and for there not to be casualties.
No, it's extraordinarily difficult, and I have absolutely not a kind word to say about Sinwar or any of his colleagues hiding in tunnels beneath all of the destruction. Nevertheless, this has been a point made repeatedly by our government to the Israelis. You know, there is a requirement in international law, and it's a practical requirement also. If you're trying at the end of the day to capture the will of civilians, there's a requirement that if you're going after a military target and there happen to be civilians in the way or in proximity, you need to apply the principle of proportionality.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Is the target so important that it really, really, really requires 100, 200 civilians to be killed or maimed in the process? I think the Israeli standard of proportionality has been very relaxed, to say the least. Okay? And it does raise real problems about international humanitarian law. And much the same thing is happening in Lebanon now. And again, I think this stems from a widespread Israeli belief that we are surrounded by people, including unarmed civilians, who would just as soon see us dead or gone. And unfortunately, this has instructed the manner in which the Israel Defense Forces have responded to the events of a year ago today.
Dr. Nathan Brown, I know you have to leave at the top of the hour. I just wanted to give you a chance for final thoughts.
Well, I would probably just end where we began. This is just a very, very discouraging time. And it is a discouraging time for those people who live in the region or who care about people in the region. And I would end perhaps just with the observation that the human rights of all the people who live there and the national rights, that is the ability of groups within the region, whether they're Israeli Jews or Palestinians, to have some kind of place where they can live, not simply as human beings, but in a national community with a state to defend them, is the long-term solution to this. I just don't see that we're going to get there anytime soon.
Dr. Nathan Brown, a political science professor at George Washington University and a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Nathan Brown, thank you so much for being with us. What a pleasure and an honor to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. We will continue our conversation with Fred Hoff and Libby Post after this short break.
Support for WMC comes from the Berkshire Health Systems Nurse Line, a community service connecting patients to care options weekdays 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., 855-855-2000. Friends of Chamber Music, presenting Amani Wins, The French Connection, October 13th, 3 p.m., the Massey Center, College of St. Rose. Ticket information at friendsofchambermusic.org. Neller Insurance, Copaig, Valencia, New Lebanon, Chatham. Family-owned, insuring homes, autos, farms, businesses, and lives, supporting public radio in the Hudson Valley, Berkshires, and Northwest Connecticut. knellerins.com. Woodland Pond at New Paltz, a life plan community at the foot of the Shuangunks, near education, the arts, and outdoor activities. Future residency waitlist available, woodlandpondnp.org. And the New York State AFL-CIO, a federation of 3,000 unions fighting for working people to keep New York State union strong. UnionStrongNY.com for more information.
This is Northeast Public Radio, WAMC FM HD 90.3 Albany, WRUN HD 90.3 Remsen Utica, WAMK HD 90.9 Kingston, WOSR HD 91.7 Middletown, WCEL HD 91.9 Plattsburgh, WCAN HD 93.3 Canajoharie, WANC HD 103.9 Ticonderoga, WAMQ HD 105.1 Great Barrington, WWES HD 88.9 Mount Kisco, WANC HD 90.1 Stamford, WANR 88.5 Brewster, WQQQ 1033 Sharon, and WAMC AM 1400 Albany.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this October 7th, the one-year anniversary of the attacks in the Middle East. And we have been spending the past hour talking about this situation and where we are. Dr. Nathan Brown, who was our guest from George Washington University, had to leave at the top of the hour. I'm sure it had nothing to do with the fact is then he didn't get to help answer the listener letters. But I leave that for Fred Hoff and Libby Post, who stay on with us to the bottom of the hour. Just a reminder that coming up in about 45 minutes or so, we're going to talk about the importance of the youth vote in this country. We are going to welcome two Hartwick political science professors. They are chairs of the Institute of Public Service. They're also going to bring with us two of their students, one who is running for office, which is really cool. So yeah. Would be the youngest mayor ever. And so that's very cool.
Where?
In Otsego.
The town of Otsego?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I actually don't know if it's town or village, but I would assume.
Well, I'm going to look it up right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, there okay. you go. All right. And you'll meet him in the green room. So
it's a town.
We'll have that conversation coming up in about 45 minutes. Okay, so let us go to some letters, and hear what we have to. What's on the minds of our listeners. Can you discuss the idea that this is about just about land? If Israel agreed to move the 600,000 settlers and negotiate with the baseline of the 1948 or even 1967 boundaries, this would be over, or at least it would start to be over. Fred?
Yeah, there's a recent proposal made by a former prime minister of Israel, Olmert, and Nasser Kudwa, who is a fellow I got to know quite well about 20 years ago or so, used to be the equivalent of Palestinian foreign minister, and their proposal is that there be a Palestinian state consisting of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and and on the West Bank, about 4%, I believe, the total territory should be ceded to Israel, because this 4% contains very, very, very large settlements that are not going to move. And that the Palestinian state would be compensated with 4% somewhere from Israel. Proposals like this have been around, but you know, it's just like everything else. Timing is everything. We can't forget about the necessity, as Nate Brown mentioned, of self-determination for everybody in this small piece of land between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. But I'm afraid that any serious diplomatic effort to bring this about is going to have to be deferred. On the Hamas side, Israel's elimination is what's sought. On the Israeli side, Prime Minister Netanyahu takes pride in opposing the creation of any kind of a Palestinian state.
Let's go to this letter from Will. Who would be better off for the Palestinians, Trump or Harris? I think Harris, without a doubt. Whatever happened to the New York Times report that Israel knew about October 7th, a year before the attack?
Oh, there's no doubt that Israel, Netanyahu was more focused on taking over the Supreme Court and moving that to the far right than anything else. And he was caught with his proverbially with his pants down. And there were warnings. The intelligence agencies were warning Netanyahu that things were not looking good, that things could happen. And if there had been, because I read it this morning, if there had been just 200 Israeli soldiers at that point where the breach happened, none of this would have happened. But they weren't. They were taken away. They were doing remote surveillance. And so, you know, there's no two ways about this, that this falls at Netanyahu's feet, but he has been able to use this war to distract from that and to bring everybody to his side in terms of we have to keep fighting, we have to keep fighting, they hate us, they want us destroyed. And just getting back to the land question, we can't forget that when Israel was established in 1948 in the Balfour Declaration, it was supposed to be a two-state solution. There were supposed to be two states, Palestinian state and an Israeli state with an economic union, and the Arab countries said no, and then they closed their borders to the Palestinians. You know, and I'm not saying, oh, we have to look at that and, you know, that's where all the blame lies, but we also need to know our history.
Yeah, and one of the reasons underlying what happened a year ago today is a longstanding Israeli policy going back previous decade or so, usually with Bibi Netanyahu as prime minister, a policy of appeasing Hamas.
A lot of money.
With guttery money. And the idea was to build up the status of Hamas as a self-governing authority in the Gaza Strip, at the expense of the PLO and Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And this all backfired in a monumentally spectacular way.
We got this letter from Diane. I agree with Libby. Because of the latest attacks, the popular voice is turning towards Bibi. The question is, what is the end game? Destruction with no vision. While you're doing what you're doing, leaves whoever is left on either side just back to the beginning. And that beginning is a new round of hate groups.
Mm-hmm. And we keep seeing it. I mean, you know, the hate groups are just proliferating and finding new targets to hate. You know, it's just, I've said this before on the air, and I'll keep saying this. I'm just so glad my parents aren't around to see this.
Yeah.
My dad fought in World War II. He knew what fascism was, you know. And again, and I've said this before, this Republican Party with Trump, none of these people fought in World War II. All the World War II vets that were in Congress have passed away. Nobody really knows what it means to fight fascism anymore. They don't even know what it really means and what the word means. Because they are rallying around one of the biggest fascists we've seen in a really long time. And that's Trump, by the way. You know, and so the hate that is being proliferated, we've gone from a politics of tolerance to a politics of hate. And some people really do well with that. Hitler did really well with that. Okay? Trump is doing really well with that. And I know people are going to take me to task for making the analogy, but I'm sorry. You know, demonizing a group of people, Hitler demonized the Jews. Trump is demonizing anyone who doesn't agree with him, but specifically immigrants, specifically non-white people, and just rallying that hate, which is going to impact this country as we move forward. I just read a piece, even if Harris wins, which, you know, God willing, the amount of political violence that may be unleashed in this country is something that we haven't seen since the Civil War. And we have to be ready for it.
Joe, if I might just say very briefly in response to Diane's point, post October 7th, 2023, most Israelis now believe there is no such thing as an endgame. And it is this belief that is driving Israeli policy right now. Most Israelis believe that, on the basis of, 1,500 years of vicious anti-Semitism, and now the difficulties that the state of Israel faces, there is no end to this. It is simply a matter of fighting, of trying to reduce the military capabilities of what Israelis consider to be permanent enemies, and yes, setting the stage for the next conflict. You know, until that kind of self-fulfilling prophecy can be short-circuited, I'm afraid we have every reason to be very pessimistic.
Libby, I'm hoping you can tell us, you were talking about the ADL at the beginning and the report that came out, I believe, in the last week. But can you just bring us to our community, to here in Albany, and just how what happened on October 7th has changed your life, has changed the life of other Jews who are going, as you mentioned, high holidays, of how it has changed over that period of time?
Well, the first thing that happened was the shooting at Temple Israel, about a month after October 7th. Thank God nobody was hurt, and they apprehended the person, and who it was clearly a hate crime. And we haven't had anything that heinous happen here. I can tell you that the Jewish community is small. We are 0.2% of the entire population of the world. And so in Albany, the Jewish community is small as well. We have a number of synagogues, all of whom are putting much more of a financial resource into security. We, at my synagogue, we've got 24/7, almost 24/7 security, 7 days a week at the very least. We have an early childhood center, so does Temple Israel. We need to have somebody there all the time. And it costs us a lot of money. I mean, and let's not fall into the trope, well, we're Jews, we can afford it. I'm sorry, but that's not always the case. And so there's been this sense that on some psychic levels, we are now in an armed camp as Jews in the Capital District. I don't think that that's playing out every single day, but it's really distressing that this is what we have to put our resources into instead of what we would usually put our resources into, which is building community, educating our children, all of that sort of stuff, making sure that our synagogues are in good shape as well. They're aging facilities. And so it's impacted the community that way. I think it's impacted the community psychically in terms of, as I said before, none of us ever thought this kind of hate we'd have to see again in our lifetimes. There are people who knew some of the hostages. There are people who have been back to Israel since to show their support. There are people in the Jewish community here that are pro-Palestinian, and there's that rift that has happened within the Jewish community, and it's really, really difficult to navigate all of that because you want to remain friends with the people you've been friends with for a really long right. time, and you have to deal with this differing politics. And it's like they'll all and I don't know if they'll all vote for Harris or not, but you know, on the left, there's now this notion of, well, if you don't agree with me on Palestine and its right to exist, don't vote for Harris. And I'm like, and that's not necessarily just the Jews on the left, but the entire left. And it's like, okay, what do you expect is going to happen if Trump gets elected? Now, in New York, we know it's going to go blue and the Electoral College will be here and we'll be fine in New York. The rest of the country, who knows? But all of this together cumulatively has, I don't want to say we're in a bunker mentality, but we're definitely looking over our shoulders a lot more than we used to or that we had to.
We are talking about the October 7th anniversary. We have Fred Hoff and Libby Post as our guests. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have about 15 minutes left in this portion of our panel conversation. Let's go back to the letters. Although, writes James, we support Israel's right to exist, let's not close our eyes to the truth. Netanyahu and his right-wing government may be winning, but they've lost the moral high ground. By killing so many people indiscriminately, Netanyahu has stooped down to the same low level as the very terrorists he hopes to destroy. The behavior of this right-wing Israeli government is a disgrace to the dignity of the Jewish religion.
Well, I think as a practical matter, what Israel has done under Netanyahu's leadership and the way it has waged war in the Gaza Strip is that it has undermined the prospect of Israeli normalization with Saudi Arabia. And with the balance of the Arab world, it's isolated Israel within the region and globally, and it's also been quite damaging to American foreign policy, because the belief is out there that were it not for an American green light, were it not for American weaponry, Israel would not be able to wage war the way it has. So in many respects, as we indicated earlier, those who planned and executed the horrific atrocities of October 7th a year ago have achieved some of their political objectives in terms of isolating Israel, and in terms of helping Israel produce the kind of image that James is referring to.
Gil writes, can you call a country democratic if it has an apartheid system and all people are not equal citizens of that country? Then we go to Patrick. Israel's continued and broadening aggression is creating more division with its neighbors in the world. After October 7th last year, much of the world sympathized with those victims in Israel in general. Today, the rampant killing of tens of thousands of innocent civilians has destroyed that sympathy and has led to an increase in anti-Semitism. Israeli credibility is crumbling and will continue to do so for generations as a result of their irresponsible and arrogant actions.
Yeah, and again, all I would say to Patrick is, try to look at this from the point of view of Israeli Jews in the wake of what happened a year ago. You don't have to accept it. You can disagree with it, but if in your own way you want to be part of the solution here, please try to understand why Israelis think they are surrounded by permanent enemies, and that even if there is no political solution on the horizon, the necessity of fighting incessantly for self-defense is very much the Israeli view of what's going on here.
Zach writes to us with a note that has a subject line, correcting errors. The U.S. hasn't been working for a diplomatic solution. That's pure propaganda. Israel, which, by the way, is not a democracy, it's an apartheid state, isn't our ally. They are our proxy, and every child an IDF murders or family the IDF bombs is more blood on our hands. Biden could stop the insanity with a single phone call, and his refusal to do so clearly indicates the actual U.S. policy, which is that Israel has carte blanche to carry out a genocide and start a regional war using our money and our weapons.
Yeah, I can assure Zach, based on personal knowledge, that the efforts of the United States to stop this bloodshed, particularly in Gaza, is not a matter of pure propaganda. I can assure you, it's not. Plenty of people who I've known down through the years have invested a lot of time, a lot of frequent flyer miles going into the region, confronting the Israeli prime minister, confronting the minister of defense. That it's not worked is beyond dispute. And I would say, the idea that President Biden could pick up the telephone, issue an order to his Israeli counterpart, and that order will be executed. I think that reveals a deficit in knowledge of how things work.
Jim writes, the sad part is I used to think Israel has the right to exist, but as the relentless and indiscriminate taking of innocent lives continues its second year, I, and I believe a good portion of the world, are wondering if their aggressive, vindictive punishment of the people of Arab descent is indicative of a state worthy of the world's support. If they want/need to fight a war, they should send their damn soldiers in and fight the battle, but not bomb the civilians out of existence. It's truly sad that I'm starting to rethink my opinion of the state of Israel. If you do not want anti-Semitic feelings to spread, please give us a reason to believe the government does not represent the view of the majority of the people of the Jewish religion.
I would just say I don't know why anti-Semitism in the United States should be linked to the behavior of a foreign state, namely Israel. One of the problems we face in this country is the willingness of too many of our fellow citizens to look at their Jewish fellow citizens and say, "You are responsible for what I am seeing on TV in terms of destruction in Gaza." We have this on both the left and on the right in the United States. I think Marjorie Taylor Greene's most recent pronouncement has been something to the effect of they, meaning Jews,
as
control
you
the weather. Control the weather. On the left, we have people, the far left, we have people who have reduced the whole human experience to a question of oppressors versus the oppressed. And they have made Jews part of the oppressors. So it's criticizing the state of Israel and its policies, that's fair game. Trying to link individual Jews and in our case American Jews to those policies is anti-Semitic.
Thank you, Fred.
Teresa writes, after the terrorist attack on Israel a year ago today and the months of death that have followed at a scale that's hard to wrap your head around, I would like to hear the panel's views on the future safety of Israel. It's hard for me to see, with the direction of the Israeli government, a safer Israel in the end. It seems like we're seeing the makings of a smoldering tinderbox for years to come. I will admit that letter was written earlier in the program, and I think we have addressed
We've addressed it. I think the writer is correct that what's going on now is very much setting the stage for bloody dangerous conflicts in the future. The pertinent fact of the matter is most Israelis, in the wake of what happened a year ago today, believe that there is no alternative, that there is no real address on the other side for a permanent, peaceful, secure political solution. I think they're wrong about that, but this is the strongly held belief.
Simi writes, stop with the Israel is in the wrong statements. They are constantly being attacked by their neighbors who want to murder them every single day. Israel is being proactive after being attacked since its inception 5,000 years ago, not 75 years. You say it didn't start on October 7th. You're right. It started 5,758 years ago. Again, also, methinks most people don't know what actual apartheid looks like. That from Simi. Then we go to Norma. Issues in Israel and Gaza did not start on October 7th. Israel has trampled on Palestinian human rights in Gaza and the West Bank for decades. The West, especially U.S., has been totally biased since Britain and the U.S. created Israel in 1948. They supply Israel with billions of dollars of arms, which they use to kill Palestinians and Lebanese people. Until they continue in this way, problems in the Middle East will continue. Stop blaming Iran and come up with a solution to free Palestinians.
Well, let's not forget why Israel was established in 1948. There were thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps, coming out of the camps, out of concentration camps. Their homes were taken from them. They couldn't go back. They didn't want to go back. I'm not sure, you know, why people would want to go back to where they were victimized in their hometowns. They were not welcome. There were ships of Jews wandering around because we do like to wander, right? So 40 years in the desert. So there were these ships. I mean, even my hero, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you know, would not allow those ships to dock in New York and in the United States. And so Israel was established as a homeland for Jews because we didn't have one. And because we lost 6 million people during the Holocaust. We cannot forget that. And that was part of the reason why Israel was established, was to give the Jews a homeland. Whether you... So we can't just say, oh, let's get rid of Israel. All right, so where are all those folks going to go who you call Israel home? But it's... This isn't an easy, oh, let's do this, let's do that, and everything's going to be great. This is an incredibly complicated situation
that
no one has an easy answer to, and you're not going to get an easy answer.
And I think one-sided indictments aren't useful in all of this. I would just remind Norma, you know, over 20 years ago, 1993, Oslo Accords, there was some hope. But there was a deadly combination that killed that hope.
Right.
An organization called Hamas, thinking that Palestinians were being betrayed by the PLO, started a campaign of suicide bus bombings in Israel, slaughtering civilians. The government of Israel, for its part, continued to expand settlements in the West Bank. That combination... Violence from one side, settlements from the other side, leads us to where we are today. So, I entirely agree that what's happening didn't start on October 7th a year ago, but to say that one side is uniquely and exclusively responsible for all of the hardship is it's not accurate and it's not helpful.
I mean, just think what could have happened if those folks representing the Palestinians sat down at the table early on. I mean, you know, years and years ago, decades ago, to try, you know, even after the October 7, the Yom Kippur War in 73, and said, okay, let's come up with a peaceful solution. Let's start doing some economic development so our people can live well on both sides of these borders. You know, it would, we'd have a different kind of reality now. But folks just went to the extremes of hate. And if you hate, then you have to kill.
Let's end with this letter from a listener who writes, "It is heartbreaking to hear many listeners demonizing Jews in the state of Israel, wishing us all peace in the new Jewish year."
Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.
We will end with that on this Monday morning for this part of the conversation. My thanks to our three wonderful guests, Nathan Brown, political science professor at George Washington University. Also, of course, to Webby Post and Ambassador Fredhoff. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Great pleasure, Joe.
We'll have a break, Congressional Corner. We'll do some lockboxing, and then we'll come back and talk to some young voters and even some young participants in the democratic process, all that and much more right after this.